Podcast, a podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. We have such a good episode for y'all today.
It's really good.
It is, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. But first, let's talk about some words.
Let's talk about some words.
Because it's that time of the year.
It is the time of the year, yeah. Maybe we'll start with the first word of the year. It's already been announced by Collins,
yes.
Which is a dictionary out of Scotland.
Okay, tell me what it is. I have no idea what it is. I don't even have a guess. Wait, let me guess. Is it about COVID?
I mean, it's not related to COVID, but that's probably not the most relevant part.
Okay, so is it about labor?
Again, yes.
Okay, just tell me. Tell me what it is. Tell me.
Permacrisis.
Oh.
Permacrisis, a term that describes an extended period of instability and insecurity.
Oof.
It's one of several words Collins highlights that relate to the ongoing crises the UK and the world have faced and continue to face, including political instability, the war in Ukraine, climate change, and the cost of living crisis. I would add COVID in there. I would add labor stuff in there. But yes.
Yeah. Oh, no, I can see why you were like, not quite, but yes. Because COVID is a permacrisis. And yeah, because so I was guessing labor because I think that anti-work and quiet quitting, I feel like are going to be the American Dialect Society, at least contenders.
They'll be nominated for sure.
Right. And dictionary.com just added anti-work to the dictionary.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to that, do you want to hear the other words of the year or potential words of the year?
From Collins?
Mm-hmm.
Was it like the runners-up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's Keefe, Partygate. Do you know about Partygate?
Mm-mm.
Basically, there was this party during one of the lockdowns in London at Downing Street, so like the Prime Minister's residence. And it eventually led to Boris Johnson having to step down, or at least it was one of the things that forced
him. Oh, that's okay. Okay. Wow.
Splooting? Do you know what splooting is?
No. What?
So there's a whole subreddit about it, which I follow, where I'm in. And it describes animals when they're like on their bellies and then they're sort of like splooted out, their back legs, you know? Splooting.
Oh my god. That's what Nico does.
Yeah.
My dog.
Yeah.
All of the time.
Yeah, my cats don't seem to do it, but some cats do. Warm bank is a heated building where people who can't afford to heat their own homes go to, because there's an energy crisis right now in Europe. No one can afford Jeez. To heat their homes. Like,
that
no
is
one
awful.
Almost.
That is horrifying.
Yeah. So they still like libraries or whatever, like public spaces that are always going to be warm.
Libraries do so much
yes.
for everyone.
Oh, I love my local library and the main library too.
Yeah, ditto.
Carolean, which is relating to Charles III of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Charles! Is that the king?
That's the new king.
Okay. I'm so American.
I thought you would know that. I don't know.
No, it took me a second. It took me a second because I was like, okay, there's Harry. And the other one that's married to Kate, and then
Charles.
Charles, dad. Okay, got it.
Lawfare, the strategic use of legal proceedings to intimidate or hinder an opponent. I guess that's a thing that's happening in the UK right now. I don't know. I think of that as like, you know, the Trump strategy.
Yeah. Wait, like a political opponent?
No, it doesn't have to be.
Okay.
You're just
interesting.
Whatever opponent you're using or that you have in a legal sense could be political, but it could be other things too.
Oh, so you're just like capitalizing on being litigious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And there is like a Lawfare podcast out of the US. So I think this concept is maybe less newly relevant in the States versus newly relevant in the UK. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
Quiet quitting.
Right, yeah.
So the practice of doing no more work than one is contractually obliged to do.
And don't get me started, by the way.
Yeah, seriously.
I feel like that's how work should supposed to be.
Yeah, you want more, you pay me more. Sports washing, the promotion of sporting events to distract attention from a controversial activity. So, for example, Qatar is hosting the World Cup right now.
Right.
And we all know how deeply problematic that country is. So they're sports washing. Vibe shift. A significant change that in the prevailing cultural atmosphere or trend.
Vibe shift. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So
I only knew like two of those.
You only knew two?
Wow. Well, no. Okay, so quiet quitting, vibe shift.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true. I guess you wouldn't have necessarily known the rest of them. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know Carolean. I'd never heard that one before, but I would say Anita O'Keefe.
Yeah, okay, okay. I've never heard it used. And
what? You've never heard the capital of Ukraine being used?
Okay, so it's being, they're just saying that they're not using it in a special way, right? But it's just the capital.
It's just used. Because it's like, it constantly in the news.
I know Kyiv then. Yes. Let me say why I was confused. It's because dictionary.com added Zelensky. And the reason why I found this interesting is because, and they even have an editor's note, the ending of this transliterated spelling uses two Ys to represent a specific Y sound in Ukrainian, which has more than one. It's also the spelling that Zelensky himself prefers. Still, you're likely to see the name spelled with one Y in some news reports, reflecting a different transliteration. So that's why I was just wondering if, like, Kyiv, there was, like, more to it than just it being the capital.
Well, it's also the new spelling, right? The K-Y-I-V spelling, pronounced right. Kyiv, or something like that, versus Kiev, K-I-E-V, yeah.
Okay, so it's closer to an English F sound than a V sound? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in between, probably.
The IPA that they give is the F.
Oh, they do? Just plain up F?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, Kiev.
Kyiv.
Kyiv. Ah! Dang it. I've been saying it right, except I haven't been saying it right. I've been saying Kyiv. Kyiv.
Yeah. Which is probably still better. They would still be, like, good enough, you know. Just right. don't pronounce it the Russian way. That's all.
No. Yeah, absolutely not. And then another one, and we actually talked off camera about this before, but they added school resource officer, and you made a good point that not every school has one of these. I just grew up with school resource officers, so I was surprised that it wasn't in the dictionary.
And I was like, well, it's not, I don't think all schools have them. I certainly didn't have them. I mean, I want them in a different country, so,
you right. know. Do Canadian schools have them, though? Like, is it possible?
Maybe. I certainly didn't have them. Like, cops came to our school. So the RCMP, because I lived in small towns, RCMP did come to our schools to tell us, you know, watch out for bad men. And, like, you know.
Dare to keep your kids off drugs? That was only United States, right?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
did you have DARE?
I don't think we had DARE, but we definitely were told, you know, beware of drugs and whatever. Like, so we had similar messaging. Yes, we had similar messaging. You know, I was in elementary school in the 80s, so,
yeah.
you know, the anti-drug stuff was pretty strong back then. Anyway, so yes, they come to the schools, but I never had one that was, like, in our school. Like, that just seems completely, like, what? No, we do. Why would we need that?
I know. Crime prevention at school. Like, come on. Come on. That's, like, a whole other podcast. But yeah, so I was surprised because I've always had them.
But I bet you there's lots of schools that don't still to this day, depending on the school, depending on the...
Yeah, if you live in a gated neighborhood,
right.
you might go to a school without a school resource right. officer.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, if you go to a school like I did, where it was 92% Latinx, you probably had a school resource officer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm shocked that it's just being added to dictionary.com's dictionary. Because they've been doing this for decades.
Yes, but it is... Even though they have existed for a long, long time, at least in some schools, it's still newly relevant because, you know, there have been so many school shootings that have involved them somehow.
That's true. Ugh, yeah. There are a couple other ones I wanted to mention to you. Shadow ban was added.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sock puppet.
Uh-huh.
And then here's an editor's note for that. For sock puppet, which is a false name or identity assumed by an internet user, often to deceive or to preserve the user's anonymity. Editor's note, this sense of sock puppet emerged in the early 2000s and continues to have relevance. A recent prominent use relates to Russian online disinformation campaigns.
What about the other one, the previous one, just because
yeah,
not everyone will know.
Shadow ban. The suppressing from public view of a social media post or post by platform moderators without notifying the user who published the content, usually in response to a violation of the platform's terms of service. But there is a lot of misuse of this. So it's not just like harmful stuff that you would wish that would be moderated. It gets sketchy, right?
Well, also, a lot of people who claim they've been shadow banned haven't been. So
true. It's like people claiming they've been canceled or claiming it's a witch hunt.
Right.
It's all related. And then here's something I haven't heard. Have you heard of this review bomb?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I know what it is. Never heard it called that. But to manipulate an online rating system with a semi-organized campaign of unfavorable user reviews, often as a general statement of disapproval for a creator, publisher, or other business, rather than genuine opinion about a specific product or experience.
Yeah, I wish I could think of an example on top of my head, but it's very common if, I don't know, it's considered to be quote-unquote too woke by the online mob.
As a verb,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool, to argue with someone or dispute someone's stated views, especially on social media. And then here's something that I have never heard, but I just wanted to share because I think it's really cool because I'm really into reading, Carrie. I don't know if you know this. No, but I'm really into like YA and like speculative and dystopian stuff. So here are two subgenres. Okay. Hope punk, a subgenre of speculative fiction and art that shows optimism, gentleness, kindness, and collaboration to be effective weapons in the fight to create a better future. And then grimdark, dystopian fantasy fiction characterized by harsh settings, extreme violence, and a bleak, fatalistic perspective on the future of humanity. So having these two kind of juxtaposition of the two,
mm-hmm.
is kind of like the world I'm living in right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the two responses, right? Like, think about the two responses to the pandemic, too, right? They're the people who are like, oh, let's care for each other by staying apart, but, like, you know, taking these steps to protect each other. And then there's the people who are like, fuck you!
Yeah. Oh, so speaking of, here's another one. Air hug was added.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And that's definitely pandemic related.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it existed before, but it certainly made it more relevant. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, just the gesture of extending one's arms as if to embrace another person, used as a greeting of expression or expression of affection without physical contact. Another one, so anti-work was added, as I've said, of or related to the social and cultural movement that distinguishes between labor, which generates goods and work, which generates goods and work, which generates wealth, and that rejects work as artificially incentivized while embracing or elevating labor as essential or intrinsically rewarding. Oh, so stimming, which I thought was cool that was added, the repetition of physical movements or articulated noises exhibited by people, especially young children and those with autism spectrum disorders and reaction to a mental or emotional state. I certainly stim. I need little things in my hands to fidget for certain things. OOO.
Whoa, this is the first one I don't know.
You do, though.
Okay.
Abbreviation, out of office.
Oh, yeah, I guess I do. Mm-hmm.
Used as a notification to colleagues or clients when an employee is on vacation, not sick, or away from the office for another reason and cannot be reached. So an abbreviation added. Oh, and here's one more that's ridiculous. Pogonophile. P-O-G-O-N-O, file. The person who likes beards. Whether you're a pogonophile yourself or just too lazy to shave, you'll agree a lustrous covering of facial hair is pretty impressive.
Pogonophile. Huh.
Yep.
This is definitely a totally new word for me, so that's nice.
Me too.
So I kind of like it when I learn a new word from the dictionary, because normally, by the time they're adding it, it feels kind of old. You know, like shadow banning or whatever. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Like,
they've got
a process that I'm not opposed to. But this is kind of cool. Cool. Well, this has been exciting. Words.
Yes, I love words. I love words. Well, that was fun. Also, this episode is great. So.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Here's another podcast we think you'll love.
It's called Subtitle, and it tells stories about languages and the people who speak them.
Which is kind of like us.
Yes.
If you've ever wondered about she, he, they pronouns in Swedish or Japanese, or why some people seem to be so good at picking up languages, then Subtitle is a podcast for you.
I've actually wondered about both of those things.
Me too.
One recent episode profiles a woman who forgot her mother tongue and then set out to rediscover it. Another is about words that seem programmed to make us laugh. Another is about our very first and very last words. What was your first word, Carrie? What'd your mom or dad tell you?
I don't remember. I remember the first question I asked when we got to the cabin, which had no electricity. I was like, where's the TV? So that clearly tells you something about me. But I don't remember what my first words were. Do you know yours?
Button.
I don't know why I find that so cute, but I really do.
Yeah. Because yeah. I was very curious about buttons, apparently.
Anyway, Subtitle is produced in association with the Linguistic Society of America and is hosted by award-winning journalists Patrick
Cox
and Kavita Pillay. Listen at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. They also have some episodes on why some people still speak Latin,
communicating with extraterrestrial beings,
linguists who solve crimes. Sign me up.
I know. Is the polyglot brain different?
And did Hurricane Katrina kill the New Orleans accent? Which, you know, is related to the, did millennials kill the Philly accent?
Exactly.
So that we have.
Yes.
So if you like our podcast, you're almost certain to like Subtitle. So go check it out.
Okay, so today we have two guests, Jonathan J. Maya, Radbois Farouche, or Feral Opossum, who is a Louisiana Creole artist and a writer from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's the third Baton Rouge Poet Laureate and writes in Kuri-Vini, an endangered Creole language of Louisiana. His family that spoke it as their first language came from Pointe-Coupée and other river parishes along the Mississippi River. He's the founder of La Tanya d'Isme, a type of colloquial visual art woven with language and physical place, and is represented by Arthur Roger Gallery in New Orleans, Louisiana. He's currently co-editing a book of poetry in Kuri-Vini with Dr. Oliver Mayu called Fevi, which will release soon. And our second guest is Adrian Guillory Chapman, who is an educator and former Catholic school administrator who was born in Lafayette, Louisiana. Although she was raised in Chicago, Kuri-Vini and French were spoken in her home and by others in the community. In 2013, Adrienne began her journey in reclaiming Kuri-Vini. Today, she has a passion to help others reclaim their heritage language, especially families who live in the Louisiana Creole diaspora. Adrienne organized lessons for Kuri-Vini on Memrise, coordinates Kuri-Vini practice tables in Chicago, and contributed to the second edition of Ti Live Creole, a learner's guide to Louisiana Creole, and to the book Oh Malheureuse, French writings by Louisiana women. In addition, she created a set of Kuri-Vini family card games, and she's currently planning a website for kids and their families who want to learn Creole. So welcome!
Yes, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much,
y'all. Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah.
So we introduced you both in English. Would you like to introduce yourselves in Kuri-Vini?
Would you like to go first, Adrienne?
Sure. Mon nom c'est Adrienne, Adrienne Marie. Et puis, moi, t'es né à Lafayette et moi, t'es élevé à Chicago. Moi, t'es commencé pour apprendre Kuri-Vini un proche 8 ans passé. Et puis, à ce temps, ma fée fait quelque chose pour Dortmund pour apprendre et tout.
et moi, mon nom, c'est Jonathan Rabois Farouche Maille. Moi, c'est Poet Laureat à Baton Rouge. Moi, t'es né et élevé là-bas et tout. Et là, mon artiste visuel et mon écrivain. Mon travail avec Adrienne sur certains projets pour Kuri-Vini, pour aider mon apprendre. Et puis aussi, mon fait ça m'appelle l'ateliérisme. C'est une manière, l'art visuel qui crée la vision et s'est mêlé avec nos langages, l'art et aussi place physique. Comme la terre.
Thank you so much. And I don't, I'm like nodding along as if I understood everything you said, but it's just like how you kind of know when you, I guess the rhythm or the pausing or whatever, I just feel like I knew exactly what you were saying.
But, I understood some of it because of the French that I know, yeah. but not all of it.
Before we hit record, we were talking about how I don't know any French. So when I say that I'm nodding along as if I understand, I don't understand any of it because I don't have that French like Carrie does.
Yeah, it's all good.
But it's so lovely for you to share that with us. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. So let's begin at the very basics. What is a Creole language?
Can I add on this little tag question of, and why do you think people misunderstand what it is? I encounter linguists who don't quite understand what a Creole language is. Why do you think it's so misunderstood?
Okay. For us, obviously it's a language. It's a form of communication between members of a community, which have a range of heritages. When various folks from different cultures come together, they have to form a common way of communicating. So it's kind of how that comes about. And then the first generation of their children begin to normalize the language structure. What we call Creole languages today came about during European colonization of Africa, Asia, and the Americas.
And I think that people misunderstand sometimes because they use the word Creole. And Creole could be used in different contexts, in different countries, in different ways. And so for people who don't know or understand Creole cultures or languages, they hear the word Creole and they think, oh, it's all the same. When Creole is really different languages, or it could refer to a culture or people.
Or even produce. We have Creole tomatoes down here. You know, they had Creole horses at some point and things like that.
Is it just because that, you know, Creole speakers were the ones developing them, or how did they get that name?
That was just, you know, a way of saying that it was grown here or raised here or born here, which is where you get Creole people. Languages as well, but maybe not every single Creole language came about the same. So, you know.
Yes, I read in one of your bios that you were Creole, and I actually had not read as someone describing themselves as a Creole person before. I don't know.
Really?
I don't know how that does not come, how it never came up. Look at Carrie's face. You can't see Carrie's face.
I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, okay, like, anyway. I guess I always thought it was referring to the language, and this was the first time it connected for me that you were talking about yourself as a person.
There's a lot of reasons for that. I would venture to say I have some theories on that, but it has a lot to do with Americanization and how we're divided, not necessarily as culture, because we're supposed to be all one culture as Americans, but that's actually just patently false that we're all just Americans. We're U.S. citizens, perhaps. There's a lot of different cultures and subcultures on this continent.
Yeah, and I would say that Louisiana is very different culturally from the rest of the United States in a way that some other states are less different from one another.
Right.
At least from my perspective as an outsider. So let's dive a little bit into the, actually, Kuribini. So can you tell us a little bit about the history of it and how it came to be?
Kuribini is a language that's native to Louisiana, and it's spoken primarily in the state of Louisiana, but it's also spoken in other areas and other diaspora areas, because Creoles move for various reasons to different parts of the country and other places. And the language sort of emerged in the early 18th century from the confluence of languages arriving in the region from West Africa and by enslaved people brought to Louisiana by the French and the Spanish. And then, of course, you had Native Americans also, and all of this merged together into a particular linguistic landscape. So the language grew up alongside Louisiana French. So that's its sister language. And it was sort of stigmatized because people would call it broken French or gumbo French. It wasn't really recognized as a language all to itself by many people. And also it was stigmatized because the language began on plantations among enslaved people, even though that's not the only people who spoke the language.
Right. And this is a really common thing that Creoles get called not a real language or just broken whatever.
Right. And also with the even when people type Creole languages, when they type it in, and this is, you know, going into like the still sort of an oppressive sort of thing, is like when you type Creole or write Creole languages in English, at least, right, when you write Creole and you always put it in lowercase. If you're talking about people, language, and cultures, they should be capitalized. Tomatoes and stuff, you know, you don't need to do that. But because if we type like French languages, if we say French languages, right, the F is always capitalized. So, but that's not always French languages that are necessarily coming from France or whatnot. Could be coming from here or elsewhere around the world, but it's always with that capital F. So we should use capital C for Creole languages and treat them with the same respect.
I agree.
And when you call Louisiana French, like sister language, were they once mutually intelligible? Are they, like, can you understand someone speaking Louisiana French if you speak Corvini?
I would say that most people, Jonathan, could understand either or. One would be probably their primary language because of the fact that people live together in the same environment. And depending on how much contact they had with someone who spoke Louisiana French or someone who spoke Louisiana French who was in contact with people who spoke Kudivini or Louisiana Creole, as, you know, we use both terms, then they could understand each other.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different for newer learners.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I assume that, you know, someone who spoke European French would have an easier time with the Louisiana French than the Creole.
It depends on where the regions from where the French person came from and the Louisiana person came from, because a lot of, you know, the different dialects of French that exist here, they came from somewhere. A lot of them exist still in France as well. It's not centered around Paris. It's in the countryside and things like that.
So what is the state of Kudivini today?
Well, today we have less than 10,000 speakers around the world. I think that's a generous estimate, perhaps. And it's also considered a critically endangered language by UNESCO. And that's been quite a few years that it was designated as such. And, you know, historically, the Center for Development of French in Louisiana, or CODEFL, they centered most of their work and their budget on the French language in Louisiana. So not necessarily on Kudivini, because at the time when it was started, you know, the DiMaggio really wanted to focus on French from France rather than any of the languages spoken here. So currently, and historically, we don't have a state institution dedicated to Kudivini. We do have Dr. Debbie Clifton, who's taught the language at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette for quite a few decades, actually. I think she's the only person who has taught it in that sense, in a higher education institution. I mean, maybe someone else has taught in another university part of the language, but I'm not sure if it was to the extent that she has. So that would be in their Department of Modern Languages, I think. But even at that, to get to the point where you get to take her class, you had to go take French before you could go and learn Kudivini with her. And so, you know, that's setting up a barrier that really shouldn't exist, because then you're, I don't know, there's something that's called this, but maybe like a kind of academic gatekeeping.
Yeah, that is gatekeeping. Yeah, 100%.
Absolutely.
But the good thing, though, is that today Kudivini has gotten, you know, most of its support through grassroots initiatives by us Louisiana Creoles. So, and not necessarily from, you know, academics who have come in and who, you know, granted, they spend a lot of time and effort to create resources for people who are kind of more or less just academics, and to boost, you know, I understand people need to make their careers and make their living and stuff like that. But when you don't go back into those communities with whatever information you've found to help them rebuild or continue or anything like that, it really just kind of says a lot about how it's not really for the community that you're extracting from. It's only about your end goal of being the expert. of someone else's language and culture. But like I said, with the grassroots initiatives, the Louisiana Creoles that have been working on this, they're descendants of its, you know, first native speakers. So such as Dr. Christophe Landry, Cliff Saint-Laurent, and Michael Chisclad. Those three boogs, Podnas, they created the orthography that we use with help from another couple of Louisiana Creoles. It's thanks to that orthography that they created a few years back. I think it was in 2015 that it officially came out. They've made audio, visual, and online learning resources for learners and relearners, because there is also people who grew up hearing the language and maybe speaking a little bit, and they're kind of relearning it. But then even so, not just the folks that created the orthography or the folks that work with them already, but folks in the community, they've begun forming their own small groups, and they learn together and they practice with their families and, you know, do things like that too. It's uplifting and it's encouraging and it's energizing to see the amount of traction that has been gained since Louisiana Creoles sort of like took back, you know, what was theirs anyway, instead of constantly having to struggle and fight with what's their own language and how they should write it or what they should be doing and this, that, and the other.
Yeah, so it's an interesting part of the revitalization process, you know, just getting something that everyone can agree on so that you can actually build on it. It's an important step.
I won't say that everybody agrees on it. Okay. And I'm talking more specifically about people who are not necessarily involved in really working on a lot of these things. People have a lot of opinions
yes.
about it. The people that had some skepticism that I've talked with, when I sit down and explain, I'm only speaking from my own experience because I don't know how everyone else has done this or what their experiences are. And maybe Adrienne has something to add. But I've noticed that when I explain to them what it is and why it is and why we do certain things or have written certain things or this, that, and the other, they kind of, oh, okay, now I understand. Or, hey, that's actually pretty innovative. And they appreciate certain things that they didn't realize before because people make assumptions all the time about what something should be.
Well, I would say that I agree with you. That, you know, a lot of times from my experience, people will say, oh, that doesn't look right. Could it be me? Or Louisiana Creole has been written before in the 1800s. They were writing, but they were using a French orthography. And I would say that those who know French and speak French and can read and write in French, they're more comfortable with that. But then when you explain that our own orthography helps to distinguish the language and distinguish the language in its own right, then people begin to understand a little bit more.
Yeah, I was looking at the French versus Louisiana Creole on the Wikipedia. And yeah, like, I can see that if you were used to the French, it would be maybe confusing at first, but it feels to me as an outsider that it represents the sounds better.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the important things as well, is that whether it was in French orthography or a Pan Creole that was more or less Haitian Creole orthography that had been used prior, what we have now is more versatile and can capture the sounds that actually come out of people's mouths better.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably true of French too. Their orthography, just like English orthography, is not very good. It doesn't represent
English,
French.
I mean, I understand why English is so difficult for people, because there's no accents or any markers to tell you how to actually pronounce a word.
No.
Even though we do have rules, but.
Yeah. No, I know. The stress.
For non-native Anglophone, non-native English speakers, that's why it's so difficult. There's no like, hey, this should go or something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
I know. And like record and record, they're just the same. No accent mark to tell you which one's record or record. Cool.
You just have to know.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Since the orthography, you said 2015 is when it was kind of settled upon. Does this mean that Cori Veni has not been used in schools?
In 1921, it was mandated by law that schools and other government agencies use English. But before that, there were schools that used French. And as far as Kuribini, we're not, I don't think there was any textbooks or anything that was standard in Kuribini used in schools. But we do know of at least one person who attested to the fact that he would speak Kuribini to his students because that's the language that they spoke, even though it was mandated to teach in English because that was their primary language.
Yeah, I would have been shocked if Kuribini had ever been taught in school. I would have been shocked.
Yeah.
Well, today there are some educators, administrators who are interested in having programs in Kuribini, not really a full-fledged language, but yeah.
Are you working with them? You're making like these family card games and these kind of things for families and or younger kids. Do you work with these kind of programs or educators?
I would say not yet, but I hope to eventually work with developing programs for schools to use.
Kuribini has been in the classroom only a little bit because there are, but it's only ever like a smaller component. And what I mean by that is like, say, for instance, you have people doing oral histories, right? So then some people will actually go record thinking that their family speaks French, but they speak Kuribini instead. So that way that happens. Some people get invited to the classroom. This goes anywhere from sometimes the French immersion programs that exist here all the way to the university level. But it's always under the context of French first. Not necessarily under the context of Kuribini first. Or I shouldn't say first, but it's always under the umbrella of French rather than it being its own thing. Last summer, I did my best to incorporate Kuribini into an art class that I taught. Now, it wasn't immersion, even though for the most part, I would ask questions in Kuribini and then also repeat them in English and stuff. But the students learned very, very, very basic things like how to say, my name is, and then whatever the name is, mon nom c'est, and then asking people, qui c'est ton nom? What's your name? You know, so very basic things like that have been introduced in the past 5 years, but not to the extent of what Adrienne is talking about, that would be for the future.
Right. These things take time. You can't just throw people into the
right.
into the water.
Well, and you know, for the most part, people are going to question it because they're going to say, well, what use is it going to do? How is it going to benefit the students? What are they going to do with it later on in life?
How do you answer that question?
Well, you answer that question by explaining to them about what it is to be part of a culture that you practice, but not really understand anything about it. But if you understood the language that helped form the culture that you still practice, and then you speak in that language and you gain those perspectives and you connect with people who still speak it, you can then more easily connect to people around the world because you're not someone who thinks that the one language is the only language. And that's, you know, that's across the board. There's quite a few instances where people who they refuse to learn any other language, and that's their own right. But I think that's also a way of limiting oneself to understanding the world in a different lens. But also, like for Louisiana Creoles, you know, a lot of folks come to learn because they want to reconnect to their heritage, right? And they understand that they've missed out on something or they lost something because they remember it in their family or they remember growing up hearing the language being spoken, or they don't know why they say certain things, but then they find out it's actually something in Kuribini that they've said all their life and it's not English, or, you know, something like that to better understand.
So to be better connected to oneself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a facet of humanity that at least for Louisiana Creoles, I would hope that they can reclaim.
I definitely think it's possible. It's not going to be easy. It never is. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's possible. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's happening.
It's happening.
It's just happening slowly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it took however many hundreds of years to get to this point. So, you know, to grow it back, it's going to take some time too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a frustrating question in the first place, because in these people's terms, wealth isn't always fiscal.
Right.
Right.
Well, and it, you know, and it still does open up mm-hmm. other avenues.
It does.
Even
yeah.
other avenues of career choices, too. You know, if that's the one thing that somebody's worried about.
Exactly.
It does that, too.
Right, right.
Yeah. It is a frustrating frame, but it is the frame that most Americans live in. And so if you're an educator, you kind of have to find ways to talk to parents. That's why I asked that question.
Oh, right. Right. Right.
Well, what is your relationship with Cordy Vinny? Did you speak it as a child? Did you hear people speaking it around you?
Well, for me, growing up, we moved to Chicago when I was young, and it was spoken in the home. My mother spoke both Cordy Vinny and French. My father could understand, but he didn't speak the language. So obviously, you know, he grew up around the language, but not encouraged to speak it. And my grandparents, my uncles, they all spoke the language in the house. However, we weren't encouraged to speak the language because there was this impression that we wouldn't do as well in school. And growing up in Chicago, I thought, oh, that's because we're in Chicago now and everyone speaks a little bit differently. But as an adult, I understood, or as a young teenager and an adult, I understood that the same thing was happening in Louisiana, where people were being told that the language is broken French, and in order to do well in school, in order to have opportunities, it's better to speak English. It, as I mentioned before, in 1921, it was mandated that English be spoken and taught, that the curriculum would be in English. And some people, not everyone, but some people were punished if they spoke either Louisiana French or Louisiana Creole in school. And so that generation of people, when they had children, they didn't want their children to be stigmatized in or to have problems in school. They encouraged the children to speak English as opposed to Cordy Vinny or Louisiana French. That happened in my family also. Later on, I would always want to learn how to speak. And I knew some things because, you know, it was spoken all around me. And so there were some phrases and words and things that I was familiar with. But I was told, well, when you get in high school, you can learn French. And then we'll teach you the way we speak the language, you know? So, and that's something that happens, a story that you hear, not just for Cordy Vinny, but for other endangered languages. When I went to high school, I wanted to learn French. And my counselor said, no, take Latin. That way you can learn all the languages, you know. And so she wouldn't put me in French. So I learned Latin. So every opportunity I had to get at least close to Louisiana Creole, it seemed like it was something that just didn't occur. But now, because of technology, I'm able to speak with people from different parts of the country and the world in Louisiana, and I'm able to learn the language.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
It's a very common story, children not being taught their language. The thing that's slightly different is, oh, no, you should learn French first. That doesn't happen with indigenous languages that I know. No one's ever told, oh, no, you should learn this one first.
And when they were saying French, they didn't mean Louisiana
right.
French. They meant the French that you can learn in school.
Yeah, Parisian French. Yeah. Which almost no one
right.
speaks.
Right.
How about you, Jonathan? What's your story?
I'm in a similar situation, but I'm here in Louisiana, you know, in Baton Rouge. So my great grandmother spoke the language. You know, she was born and raised in Lakeland in Pointe-Coupée. And so she spoke it all throughout her life, you know, throughout all her days with her family, her sisters, her cousins, and the rest of her family. So that was my great grandmother. I never met her, but my dad was really close to her. And so she lived with my dad when he was growing up. And his mom, my dad's mom, my grandmother, she spoke it until she was around about seven or so, which is the whole, you know, the thing about going to school in English and, you know, just you're not going to get anywhere if you keep speaking our, you know, that language. My grandmother understood it, but didn't really speak it. But my dad, heard it all the time. And he would say some phrases when I was growing up. He would say some words and a couple phrases or whatever, but nothing more than that. But the one thing that he did recognize and he understood was that he understood the nuance of the language and the rhythm and the sound of the language. So he could distinguish when I was speaking, when I would speak French, he wouldn't say much about it. But when I spoke Kuriveni, one day he told me when we were gardening, he was like, that sounds just like my family. Like, that's my family speaking when I hear you speaking it. And so, you know, there's still like the understanding of like just the sound is even that much is really important too, right? But I did do the same sort of thing. I learned French first. I took some French classes growing up, but it didn't really stick because I then went into Spanish, mainly because all of my friends were taking Spanish and that didn't stick. So after college, I was like, okay, I need to start learning French. So I started learning some Louisiana French things and didn't do anything for me because I wasn't around anybody speaking it. I thought I could learn it all on my own. So when I got, I think it was in 2015 as well, when I went to French immersion in Canada, where some of my lineage is from, you know, I have lineage from straight from France, some Quebec, some Belgium and stuff like that. But anyway, I went there to start French immersion and I learned French at University of Sainte Anne first. And then in 2018 is when I started really learning Kuriveni after working with Cliff Saint-Laurent on a translation project and an art exhibition where he put everything in Kuriveni. And I started learning through the community that Adrienne was involved in. This also includes Cliff and some people that I mentioned earlier. And I had known that we had spoken Creole, but it took me a long time to really understand that it is not French. Cause I, you know, my parents had, they got me a book about Creole from Pointe-Coupe, Kuriveni from Pointe-Coupe. I went back and read all of that and to better understand some of what was being spoken. And so now I do have some people around me that I can speak with. It's not a whole lot of folks, but then like with Adrienne, the online community, you know, thanks to technology, I mean, that's really where I learned a lot is through Adrienne, Dr. Landry, Michael Gisclad, and Cliff Saint-Laurent, and a few other folks online.
So through the diaspora?
Yeah, through the diaspora.
Get together mm-hmm. and like Zoom?
Yeah, Zoom, Facebook, all these sorts of things. You know, and those have evolved into different platforms even still. There's some folks who think that like everybody just exists online and no one knows anybody in right. person or no one speaks to anybody in person. But that's also assumptions from people who have no idea, you know, and people who aren't
people are
on
so
the ground.
Good at that.
They're really great at that, you know. But I'll be the first to tell you when people talk, when I see and read and hear things like that, I'm like, you know, I haven't spoken to them in person or they didn't come to any Creole table that was in person or they didn't go to some sort of event or, oh, they don't even live around where the people who speak live.
Are some of your ancestors part of the Acadian expulsion from Nova Scotia?
Yeah, some of them are. One of them, I descend from also the Melançons who co-founded Grand Pré in Nova Scotia, which was like a large area of land in the bay that was reclaimed for farming purposes. But they came after my French and German ancestors who were already here in Louisiana, who were already speaking Kuriveni in French, I would imagine. I don't know for sure, but I would imagine because they were in the same places where all of the where the languages exist and existed and still exist.
I was looking at a map. Lakeland is not too far north from Baton Rouge.
No, it's not correct? It's not too far, no. About 35 and miles, 40 minutes or so.
So you would say, like, mostly from your great grandmother to you, your family has mostly been around this area.
The river parishes, yeah. On my dad's side.
Okay.
My mom's side is a different story.
Yeah. We all have complicated ancestries.
It's just as interesting. It's just a different part.
Melange et Moon, different types of people in Louisiana. I have Acadian ancestry.
Oh, yeah. Also.
That's right.
There's one of the misconceptions that people have is that people of Acadian descent speak Louisiana French, and people of Creole, Louisiana Creole or Cuivini, but people of Acadian descent are Creole people, technically. And people may say, my parents spoke French because they identify as French. Or they may say, my parents spoke Creole because they identify as Creole. And their ancestors actually spoke French. People really need to understand that there's such a mixture in Louisiana. And as my mother would tell me, in Louisiana, you don't know who's who or what's what.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And, you know, so that is also why the use of the term Cuivini is at least important, you know, for us, because it distinguishes that we're talking about the language, not the people, nor the culture. Because what Adrienne was explaining with the French and Creole and this, that, and the other, you know, there's just constant confusion in intertwining the two all the time, or not exactly knowing how your language is described or named and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah.
And it also shows just how like complicated these divisions are. You know, like Scots and English are very closely related too, but they are still separate. But it's really hard to really show that divide.
Mm-hmm.
Really want to talk to you both about your art. Adrienne, can we talk about your writing? Is this something that you have been doing to reconnect, or is you writing Cuivini?
When I started to actually reclaim the language to practice, I would write. And so it was a discipline I had. Every morning, I would practice by writing. And as a reward at the end of the day, I would practice also by reading and writing in Cuivini. And I started writing poetry. Sometimes I would write stories and I would say, oh, that story seems like it wants to be a poem. And so I would write poems. And actually, there was a book that was being put together and Jonathan told me about it and he encouraged me to submit a poem. It's called O'Malheureux, French Writing by Louisiana Women. And that was the first time that one of my poems was published.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I thought, oh, okay, I can do this. It was exciting. Yes, it was exciting because it was in Cuivini. And there are some poems and songs and stories, especially Louisiana folk tales, that's written in Cuivini. And so it felt really great to be a part of that tradition of writing in the language, in the heritage language.
And I love that cover. I mean, I'm just like, very, very lovely cover of the volume.
And since then, I've written poems for Fabi. The book was actually published this year.
This is the one that y'all mentioned
that
Oliver Mayu and I were working on. It was published this year.
And it's completely, I'll let Jonathan talk about it because he and Oliver actually got the idea and put it all together. I've also worked on doing a course on Memrise, and a lot of people, that's their initial way of reclaiming the language. They go on Memrise and they learn, and then they learn about the different communities that you can find in order to practice together. And then we also have a book called Tea Leaf Creole, and I helped Dr. Nathan Winty and Dr. Oliver Mayu, who were both linguists, to look at Tea Leaf Creole and because I'm an educator, to see how people would relate to it in terms of learning the language, and especially with my being a learner also. So, yeah, it's a lot of things that have been happening in in Cuivini since I started to reclaim the language. Oh, and I also do this because I did look at your bios, and Carrie, you like to knit.
I do, right? Yes.
And Megan, you like cross stitching.
Yes, you crochet.
I crochet. And so I crochet.
Look at that.
I crochet blankets. I crochet blankets with graphics and words in Cuivini.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. I love that. I'm a very
beginner learner of crochet. That's really impressive.
Okay, well, what about you, Feral Possum?
So as Adrienne was saying, by the way, the crochet stuff really is awesome. I mean, all the stuff that Adrienne has done is awesome, but I saw those and they're wonderful. But so Favy, the book of poetry that Adrienne mentioned that she submitted work for, just came out this year in May. So I worked with Dr. Oliver Mayu, and we worked for over a year on editing the book, you know, trying to make sure that we have everything as much to a T as possible. Our publisher is actually Le Cahier de Tantamar, so it's with the Centenary College of Louisiana. We worked with the editor-in-chief, Dana Kress, Dr. Dana Kress. So thanks to him for believing in us and giving us, you know, pretty much the go-ahead and free rein on how we want to do our book. So front-to-back cover, it's all in Kudivini. There's a handful of different words in English or maybe some French in one poem or two, but for the most part, it's one of the first books that centers Kudivini and uses it throughout the whole entirety of the book, rather than having all translations. So even the Comité Édité Direction, yeah, copyright, ça c'est l'hôtel la yéchambo droit la l'hôtel poème publié dans l'anthologie ici là. So it's essentially saying that the authors retain the rights and stuff like that. So that's all there.
Yeah. But what does Favy mean?
Favy means a few different things. Smothered okra. It can also just mean okra, you know, because Favy, okra, or okri, and gombo, those are all African terms for okra. And one of the things that I really like that Dr. Mayu said is like fe la vie, like instead of so Favy or fe la vie or fe vive. It's like make live or give life and things like that. So, you know, it's a book that, you know, the language is smothered. So smothered okra, right? So it's smothered, but really good to eat. You know, it's nourishing. So like it's good to consume, or at least what I mean by that is nourish yourself by reading it and understanding where a lot of these folks are coming from. So, you know, and it has folks in there that are from older speakers, native speakers, and a lot of learners. So it's sort of a testament to the people that are learning as well. But yeah, I was so excited when Adrienne submitted as well. But I mean, everybody too, but the Omalieuse, when Adrienne applied, you know, Michael Gisclad and I listened to Adrienne, you know, she read her poem to us and we talked about it and we were so encouraging. I was so excited when she emailed us back. All right, I submitted. You know, just very quietly. I'm proud of my friend Adrienne.
I didn't pay him, but when I have a fan club, I'm going to make you the president.
President and treasurer.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really great stuff in Favy. So Adrienne's work, I'll say Brian Anthony Gradney's work in there. He's someone who is also from Baton Rouge, but he's out in Houston. I worked with Corey Leday, who's a Zydeco musician. We wrote a poem. it's a pretty funny poem. Again, Cliff is in there, Cliff Saint Laurent, bien sûr. But there's a lot of folks in here who, like I said, are reclaiming the language and reconnecting to heritage. So it's been an important, I think, piece of literature for the community. And we hope we look to do a lot more. So
you use the orthography.
Right. We use the orthography. We do use the orthography that we use for the majority of the book. There's some folks who, you know, some of the folks who they don't know the orthography yet because there's the older generations who they had their own orthography or how they wrote themselves. You know, it wasn't necessarily something that was easily picked up or that they studied yet. And I'm talking about people like in their 60s, 70s. But theirs, we left pretty much alone because we didn't want to change their particular writing style. But everybody's bios and stuff are in the orthography. Because of the language loss that we experienced in my family, I felt as though I kind of like missed out on certain stories handed down or any sort of things like that handed down. So I create a lot of my own tales, mythological tales or fantastical tales and things. They're usually in the form of micro stories, but I look to get into longer longer forms of writing.
What's a micro story?
A micro story is just shorter than a short story. So it's, you know, maybe a page or less, a couple paragraphs maybe. I think it's up to 1,000 words or something like that. Yeah, I don't usually get close to that because it's, you know, just a snippet of, you know, I go visit different places, take some photos and experience the place and talk to the people that live there, or do some research on the history of the place and then write about like just some things that occur.
Oh, well, I could talk about this forever, but I think that's a good place to stop.
I mean, we're going to talk to him later. We're best friends now.
That's right.
Best
friends, so. That's right.
Well, we appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been a beautiful hour. And thank you for sharing what you've shared with us.
C'est pas rien.
And what we share with our listeners after every episode is
don't be an asshole.
Is there a way to how would you say it?
To say that in
parfait pour masse. like don't, you know, don't be messy.
I like it. Don't love be
it.
Messy.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that, Adrienne?
Sois gentil. Mm-hmm.
Sois gentil.
Sois gentil. Mais dot phrase mon CD brasse pas la mer.
Yeah,
like brasse
pas la mer. Yeah.
Don't stir the mess. The caca.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
Amazing. That's awesome.
This month, we would like to thank our 3 newest patrons.
Yay.
AP.
Yay.
Marissa Mokia.
Yay.
I hope I'm saying that right. And Allison Smith.
Yay. I love it. Thank you so much. We appreciate yes. you.
Yes, we do.
And if anyone else wants to become a patron, we have so many bonus episodes for you to listen to when you sign up at this point. Go to www.patreon.com/VocalFriesPod.
And our most recent episode is about talking to your cat. So if that's something you're interested in, go check it out.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at VocalFriesPod. You can email us at VocalFriesPod@gmail.com, and our website is VocalFriesPod.com.